WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. Sex is the most private of private subjects. Most of us would have no interest in revealing the details of our sexual lives to others, and we might not want to know about the intimate details of anyone else's. That's why some people think Richard Rhodes was crazy to write his new memoir, while others think writing the book was an act of courage. His new book, Making Love, is a memoir of his sexual life. It's a companion book to his previous critically acclaimed memoir, A Hole in the World, about how he was abused by his stepmother. Rhodes has quite a resume. He won a Pulitzer Prize and a National Book Award for his book, The Making of the Atomic Bomb. His book, Farm, was a profile of a family farm. In his new memoir, he reveals that he also ghost-wrote two sex manuals. I asked Richard Rhodes to read from the preface of his new memoir, Making Love.
There are war stories and tales of survival. There are political memoirs and confessions of faith. But in all of Western literature, there are only a very few personal narratives that honestly and frankly explore the intimate experience of making love, and hardly any to which an author has been willing to sign his name. Although sex is one of the perplexing, joyous, difficult, and transcendent experiences of life, although studies indicate that people think about sex dozens of times every living day, hardly anyone has come forward to write about it intimately except behind the mask of fiction. Fiction is fine, but using fiction as a disguise makes both the uniqueness of intimate experience and its common humanity easy to dispute. Making love is fact, verity, as I call nonfiction. It happened. Everything in this book is true. Why talk about it?
That's my first question. Why talk about it?
Well, you know, it's as if I walked into a place where there was a wall and climbed to the top of the wall and discovered that on the other side was this lush garden with all sorts of curious topiaries and beasts running around in the undergrowth, and none of the guys with their notebooks were there. This is a huge part and a common part of human experience, and except for fiction, where I think we always have the question, did this really happen or is this guy making it up? Very little is ever said. As a writer, I saw it as an area of opportunity. As a human being, I'm curious to know about other people and their behaviors and wanted to write about, therefore, my own.
You know, although we think about sex, I think it makes us uncomfortable to hear the intimate details of someone's life. Even like really kind of prurient people, I think, get vaguely embarrassed.
Oh, yes. No, in fact, the experience that I've had since the book has left my desk has been friends, often very sophisticated friends, who, having read the book, have nothing whatsoever to say about it. It's as if this particular discourse is not available in a public forum.
Well, I think you're a very brave man for writing this book, because I think, you know, writing a sexual memoir really leaves you open to ridicule, because people love to ridicule people about their most intimate feelings and thoughts.
Oh, yes.
Fantasies.
And already in at least one of the reviews that the book has received, I've had a good round of ridicule. I understood that when I sat down to write this book. But given the premise, which is I would simply tell the story of my sexual experiences through my life, some of them, not all of them, the best of them, and maybe some of the worst of them, too, I assumed that ridicule would be one of the responses, as it has been for many people who have been revealed in one way or another publicly over the years.
Another response would be, well, this guy must have a touch of the exhibitionist in him.
Well, I hope we all do. And I would certainly assume that anyone who writes must have, especially someone who writes, as I do, not only about facts, but also about personal experiences. In my previous books, working on a farm or writing about my childhood, I mean, I've been down that road already.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Richard Rhodes, and he won a Pulitzer for his book on the making of the atom bomb, and he has a memoir called A Hole in the World. His new book is a memoir about sexuality and love. It's called Making Love. And we're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Richard Rhodes, author of the new book, Making Love, an Erotic Odyssey. It's a memoir. Since this is a subject I assume you've thought about a lot, I want to ask you if you think there's a difference between what is stimulating in fantasy and what is stimulating in real life, and whether you've found there to be a direct correlation most of the time or not in your own life.
There is a long chapter in Making Love about autoeroticism, about self-stimulation. I think I make it clear there that that particular experience of mine, which has been extensive and practiced for a very long time, has its differences from my sexual experience with women, with partners. The difference has to do, I think I finally came to understand, with my use of self-stimulation as a kind of a laboratory for learning to deal with all the rage that came out of my child abuse. Sex is one place where people put their emotions and learn to deal with their emotions, whether it's sex with themselves or sex with others. And so for me, at least, those two kinds of behaviors are significantly different. They're both pleasurable, I think, but the one has a much larger component of violence, if you will, than the other. Perhaps one of the reasons autoeroticism has been important to me as someone who came out of being abused, not sexually by my stepmother, but very close to sexually. My stepmother tried to control and did manage to control when I would go to the bathroom at night, and that was a particularly exquisite and genital torture.
Well, she'd prevent you from going at night. You weren't allowed to use the toilet at night.
And it's and that experience clearly for me as one human being with a particular personal history may be very different from what other people have. But for me, there's a disjunction between my intimacy with a woman and my intimacy with myself.
Well, I could think that one connection. You know, the genitals serve dual functions. You know, of course, with both pleasure and elimination. And, your mother inflicted pain on you in the elimination area because she wouldn't allow you to use the bathroom at night. And, do you think that somehow, like, pain and pleasure ever connected in your mind because of that?
Well, one of the things that I explore in Making Love is the degree to which self-stimulation became a way, a drama, a ritual and a drama, rather obsessive, to triumph over that cathartic childhood and repetitious childhood experience of what has to be called simply torture. Because the climax of self-stimulation is release. And that's exactly what my stepmother, in the context of urination, refused to allow me. So each time over my lifetime, I have used self-stimulation, if you will, I've refought a battle and won it.
You know, I guess what I always want to know in situations like this is if you feel that your sexual thoughts, sexual fantasies are somehow caught up with or reflective of something terrible that happened in your life earlier, like abuse, do you try to disassociate yourself with that and say, well, I'm going to try to not feel this because I think this feeling comes out of something bad that happened in my life? Or do you just accept that there's some connection there and work with it? Do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. I think one of the points of writing about this part of my sexuality is to discuss an area of healing from violence that most of the literature about child abuse and healing doesn't discuss, which is to say, the use of one's sexuality as a healing process. I think that this particular pattern for me does involve going through those complex feelings of violence and rage as well as pleasure to the other side, with the other side being something that's physical and orgasmic and very deeply pleasurable.
You know, as we talk, I feel like reassuring listeners by saying, I know this might sound a little intense to you, but hey, he's a Pulitzer Prize winner. Do you know he got a National Book Award? Do you feel that you could have only written this book in a way with the credentials that you have?
Yes. In fact, I think of the example of Bill Masters, William Masters. He wanted to study human sexuality from medical school. One of his advisors suggested to him that he should first make his name in some other area of medicine. And in fact, Bill Masters pioneered estrogen replacement therapy as a gynecologist researcher. Then and only then, when he felt he had credentials that required others to take him seriously, did he explore this very touchy and difficult area of human experience. I felt the same way.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are other reasons why the book came through. It was after I'd written A Hole in the World, after I talked about what to me were much more difficult things to discuss, such as this, what we've just been discussing, torture, being tortured. It was considerably less difficult to talk about something that I share with most other people, which is my sexuality.
The last third of your book is, as you say, a love story, a sexual love story. You meet the woman who you're still partners with, and you describe your relationship, but you also describe, you know, many, many afternoons and nights of lovemaking. One of the things that you and she tried, especially early on in the relationship, was extending sexual response. And she often had multiple orgasms. And I guess it's, you know, toward the end of the book, she says to you that she doesn't want that anymore, and you get very angry with her.
Yes, yes.
Why was that your response, getting angry with her?
Well, I had been pursuing what was essentially a vision that had been a part of my fantasy life for many years, of a woman who might be perpetually orgasmic, perpetually satisfied. That tied my relationship with G back into the complex feelings I had from my stepmother years. Here was, in a woman, what I had been looking for within myself, a release, an enormous release. And following that fantasy in the relationship had distracted me from my partner as a fellow human being with her own interests and her own degrees of pleasure, her own levels of intensity that she wanted to pursue. And finally, we came to a point where we realized there was something wrong and worked it through to the point where she told me what was wrong, which is that I was pushing too hard. Well, that was very difficult to accept. It took me all summer of talking it through with her to accept the fact of her separate humanity and her separate needs. I think it was a marvelous lesson for me as someone who had been driven to follow a particular fantasy and to find it in a relationship. That, of course, was not all that had developed in the relationship, or it would not have survived the conflict. We had also found in each other two people who were very similar. Her background was also one of abuse as a child. We had a lot of similar interests.
How does it feel for you now to be in a relationship that isn't new and isn't at its initial kind of sexual euphoria? Do you know what I mean? Do you feel that you need to always have that?
No. In fact, what happens, I think, in any relationship is that if you pay attention to each other, is that you get very good at pleasuring each other. Then the trick is not to get so good that you reduce the surprise, that you reduce the new possibilities of stimulation to the point where the kind of, I don't want to say boredom, because I've certainly never bored with her, where there's a reduction in the intensity of feeling. That's a trick and that's a problem, and I think every relationship has that problem. So we're at a very comfortable level now. In fact, what we find most of all, as most people who are active do, is trying to find enough time for lovemaking in the course of every week. So that's pretty normal. And I think one of the things I celebrate in the book in describing this relationship is the achievement of what both G and I think of must be normal, because normal wasn't part of our past. it's nice to feel as if we might be closer to what other people would say is normal, sexually and otherwise.
You know, but you get a lot of sympathy for people when you've had a past that isn't normal, if you've been abused and you've been a victim. If you have a life that isn't considered sexually normal, you get a lot of ostracism and a lot of distrust.
Oh, well, of course, we see it in all sorts of ways in America today. It's horrifying. It's horrifying that an area that we all have in common, that is, as people used to say, the poor man's pleasure, that to me is... the bedroom is the place where democracy begins. It's the first place where two people are together and have to negotiate their relationship. That's a little political system. That's the first little nation state, if you will. And that's why I think it becomes such a politicized area of human behavior, politicized by religions, politicized, as we've seen recently, in politics. This whole terrible cant about family values and the terrible homophobia that goes with it. These things all point out just how significantly this is a little cauldron of freedom. And I'm not surprised that a lot of people want to manipulate it.
Well, Richard Rhodes, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry.
Richard Rhodes' new memoir is Making Love. This is Fresh Air.